Welcome to episode 9 of the Dean's Podcast, the podcast about issues shaping graduate studies in Canada. This podcast is brought to you by University of Paris Magazine. My name is Carolyn Waters, and I'm the Dean of Graduate Studies at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I'm also the president of the Canadian Association of Graduate Studies, CAGS, for the year 2009. Every month, you can listen in as I talk to other deans, faculty, postdocs, and graduate students about where graduate studies is going in Canada and internationally. In this episode, I talk to Janice Deacon, Associate Vice Principal and Dean of Graduate Studies and Research at Queen's University. We were in Quebec City at the summer meeting of the Council of Graduate Schools, where Janice presented in a seminar called Master's Attrition and Completion, What We Know and What We Need to Find Out. So we discussed some strategies to reduce attrition and help students to complete their studies in a more timely fashion. So listen in, but first a message from our sponsor.
Hi, my name is Dick Sullentaus, and I'm responsible for all career advertising and university affairs. Did you know that most graduate students don't know where to look for academic jobs? Simply because their supervisors haven't told them. Tell the PhDs and postdocs you advise to visit www.universityaffairs.ca for the latest job offers in every discipline. It's free, and it's updated daily.
Hello. I'm Carolyn Waters from Dalhousie University, and I'm here today at CGS in lovely downtown Quebec City with Janice Deacon. So we've been here today with CGS. It's their summer meeting, and they've been talking about attrition of graduate students, the role of master's degrees, and it's been quite interesting because we've got the two different North American perspectives here and a lot of Canadian deans here as well, so we've been pretty well represented. Janice gave a talk on Sunday about the attrition rate and completion rate of PhDs and masters in Canada. So Janice, do you want to just walk us through that data a little bit?
Sure, Carolyn. I actually gave the data for Queen's. So the question was, what do, from CGS's point of view, what if they are going to undertake a master's completion project and attrition project similar to their PhD completion and attrition project, what might be some of the information we have on hand and information that we need to get. And so I pulled cohort data from Queen's for the 2000 to 2004 cohorts. At Queen's, we allow master's students up to 5 years to complete, and so the 2004 would be the last complete cohort. And my associate dean and I compared that with our cohorts for the PhD side, which were really 2000 to 2002 cohorts. And surprisingly, but I suppose pleasantly surprisingly for us, overall, the attrition rates for us of our master's degree programs run somewhere between a low of 4 to a high of about 10%. We looked at it by gender, and there were no gender differences. Interestingly, we looked at it by sort of disciplinary areas, so humanities, social sciences, and so on, and we had the lowest attrition rates in the humanities and social sciences, which I think would be surprising on the 30,000-foot view, and higher attrition rates, that is the ones closer to 10 or 12% on engineering and physical sciences. But at least at Queen's, when, you know, I can make attributions about that, or at least hypotheses about that, we have, I think as a result of many of the long times to completion in previous cohorts, there our English department and our history department and many others have gone to one-year masters. And so some of the low attrition we see in the humanities and social sciences, I think could be attributed to those are one-year programs, whereas in the physical sciences, they're two-year programs.
So when did you start the one-year program? I'm actually wondering about the tail of this. If we're talking about 4 or 5 years to complete a one-year master's, or has that shift been more recent?
I don't have the data on when they started one-year programs, but certainly they started the one-year programs before the cohorts that I'm describing. So, yeah, so I think, you know, all in all, and our attrition rates on the PhD side at Queen's run in the, you know, 15 to 18%. I mean, certainly higher than on the master's side. And one of the things I think we need to look at and CGS should look at is what opportunities do you give students to finish? And in the master's, I think we in general across Canada are better at and getting better at offering students alternatives. So whether they do a course-based master's or whether they do a master's degree that's got a project, whether it be 1 or 2 years or the full-on thesis route, there are at least 3 options in most cases for students to be successful.
And do you let them switch back and forth? Dalhousie, we let them switch back and forth.
As we do at Queen's. So if they choose to, you know, typically they wouldn't switch into a thesis route. They would switch out of a thesis route to a project, route.
So this brings up a couple of questions I'd like to follow up. And one is the difference between the attrition rates of the different disciplines. Do you have any feel for, is that related to employment market? Is it related to supervision? Do you have any feel for why some disciplines are different than others?
Well, I think the science model of a mentor adds a level of unpredictability, brings a level of unpredictability to it that perhaps the course-based or even project-based master's programs, where perhaps less rides on the relationship that you and I have as student to supervisor. And so I think some of the higher attrition in the sciences is that there are techniques to be learned that haven't been learned as undergraduates, so bench techniques or scientific techniques. There is that relationship that needs to be worked at. Expectations need to be clear, both on the supervisor and student perspectives, and competencies have to be clear and established. And it seems to me that in each one of those are all good things, but they all introduce the element of at least a binary decision. They're successful. It's working or it's not working. And I think that there are less options on the science side if things don't go well and if the supervisory relationship breaks down. My guess is that there is a higher probability a student might leave.
Or at least end up in my office.
Yours or my office, right?
So the other part of this, of course, I'm in computer science, and so I see we have a high proportion of foreign students, and I'm wondering if there's any relationship between foreign students' attrition rate and Canadians' attrition rate, and partly connected, at least in computer science, we saw years where we couldn't get people to finish because they had these great job opportunities, and I'm wondering if that's now a finished thing or whether there is any residual difference in these two populations.
Right. So you're asked a number of questions, only a couple of which I can answer. So when I was preparing my thoughts for this and the data that we generated at Queen's, international students, regardless of discipline, in our cohorts that I described earlier, had a marginally higher attrition rate than domestic students. And I flagged that as an issue at the CGS meeting that people need to be very concerned about, because that could be attributed to all kinds of reasons. And also when we did then the matrix of visa status by program, the programs that I described as being higher, that is the physical sciences and engineering being higher attrition rates overall, also showed higher attrition rates on the international side. So in answer to your first question, yes, they seem to be higher at Queen's on the master's side for those disciplines. Across our divisions, international students finish in general on time or earlier than domestic students. And we attribute that as well to some of the financial pressures. They know they've got X number of years of funding and they need to finish that degree. So while we show slightly higher attrition on the master's side, we show, in fact, marginally faster yeah, times to completion for those who stay.
So that was the second point that I really wanted to follow up, and that's, there's one thing to keep people in the program and have them complete, and another is timely completion. So we generally look at sort of 3 and 7 years. So we'd like to get our master's out in 3 years, and we like to get the PhDs 5, 6 years, depending on the discipline.
Right.
So in your data, did you identify any factors that would really have an impact on the time to completion? So presumably with a one-year master's, you want to be bringing that down.
Right, and the times to completion, and so I didn't present time to completion data here at CGS, but what I can say is that on the master's side, our times to completion are in general at Queen's, not problematic. They are finishing our one-year masters have an average completion time of approximately 1.0 to 1.2 years.
So you've got a long tail on this.
So they are graduating on time. And in fact, the two-year programs are finishing close to time. Again, the physical sciences would be the place where there is some, often there's a longer tail in terms of the time to complete. And, you know, the attributions to some of that are, is the project a manageable size? So what's the mentorship like and the role of the program in establishing the boundaries on the student project? Because all of our two-year masters are research-based. And what's taking them the time to finish at the end is clearly getting their research finished and their projects written up or their theses written up at the master's level or, of course, their dissertations. So I think that scope of work is a problem and or is an issue that needs to be looked at. And I think you raised a point about people going to the job market. In the last few years, we've seen the engineering departments indicate that not only is it hard to get engineering students to come to do a master's when they can go to Alberta and enter into a profession and be very, very well paid, the problem of them leaving. Our mining department, which just comes to mind because I had a conversation with them a couple of weeks ago, said many people who do a graduate degree in mining can go out, and in fact their industry partner or the person that's trying to hire them compels them to leave. They're happy that they're in graduate education, but they'll be more happy when they're out at the rock face, working for the company.
So part of that is actually educating our industrial partners that they will be better off to wait the 6 months and get somebody who's finished and who has more to offer them. But we don't do that either. So,
right.
So one thing that sort of comes to mind when you're talking is this issue of supervisors in programs where there aren't PhDs, actually getting their PhD-style research done on the backs of master students by making these sort of three-year master's efforts out of what should be a year, year and a half, or 2 years. Did you find any correlation between completion times where there were both a master's and a PhD's versus a master's only?
We at Queen's, we would have very few programs that are master's only that aren't professional. So for most of our research-based programs, we have a PhD available as well, and so I don't have the data on that. Although here at CGS, certainly people have raised that as an issue, that if your help is coming from well-trained master students and you don't have PhD programs, and of course it's in the interest of the faculty member to keep those competent people around to help with the overall research project.
So where do you think we should go from here in terms of the Canadian Association of Graduate Studies? Do you think we should be looking more closely at the masters? What would be a top priority for you in this area?
That's a very good question. I think another part of the interesting presentation we had today was the Did You Know YouTube 5-minute display in it. Does speak to how quickly information is changing and learners are changing. And I guess I resist the thought that the ivory towers of universities have existed for hundreds of years and we should just continue doing what we're doing. I think that's not reasonable. So I think we need to explore with our colleagues the extent to which developments, either program developments or modularization of some of our programs. So, for example, rather than creating new master's programs because there's a societal requirement, do we have flexibility within the program? And Doug Pierce from York said today, could you build certificate or diploma programs? I think we need to talk about flexibility in graduate programs. But I think, a large problem with the confusion between the first and second cycle, the BA and the master's level cycle, and that it's probably a good thing that those two cycles have some gray area, that they share some things. I think certainly on the PhD side, I mean, whatever we do, we need to be distinct, that a PhD should be training people who have serious training, serious skills in inquiry, serious skills in interpretation, and that those are well developed, so that we are graduating benchmark people on the PhD side.
So we've just finished our second survey of people coming to Dell, or not coming to Dell, but telling us why and what they're doing. And we found a noticeable increase, up to about 23% of the PhD students not intending to be university professors, but actually looking at policy issues in the government and private sector labs and things like that. So have you noticed any shift in what people are expecting from the piece? So from the academic point of view, we actually expect the same thing we always expected, but the students coming in are having different expectations. So do you think that has an impact on the way we actually approach these degrees?
I think we need to give that serious thought, but I think one of the things I'd like to know more clearly is what's the percentage of PhDs that have gone to industry or gone outside? And my guess is that if it's around 25%, that hasn't changed as much as some might like to think in the, sort of the 2009 context. And I think the Tri-Councils have got it right. I think that CAGS has got it right in thinking that how much do we need to change and how much do we need to augment? And I think there is the notion that our PhD training has been very highly defined and very narrow, myopic, some might say, and that we haven't spent, until fairly recently, much time discussing what are the other set of skills that our PhD students should need. They're going, if they're faculty members or members in a profession, the ability to work in to build teams and work in teams, to be able to be so interdisciplinary in terms of discussion. Some of the, what some might attribute to business schools, soft skills, the HR skills, that I think it's valuable that we have the discussion as to what extent grant writing and the like can be either encompassed in the degree programs or, in our own case, through a series of workshops and value-added elements that we as graduate deans can mentor in our own institutions and have, perhaps as even certificates, right?
I love certificates. I just print them out the back of my printer. But actually, if we start thinking along those lines more clearly in a national kind of framework, I think we also have to address most of our master's students. So master's students getting even research degrees also need those skills if they're not going to go on to PhDs. If we keep the value of our master's degree intact, then I think we need to think about their professional needs as well. So it's not.
I think that's entirely true. And I mean, it's one of the things that I like and am intrigued about in the American Professional Science Masters is this, what they refer to as the plus element. And the plus element are many of the things that I've just attributed to the skill set that I think PhD students should also be exposed to. But perhaps you're right that at the master's level it's even to a greater extent given the variety of occupations and professions that they may go to. And I mean, I think those are challenges for our institutions because there's no doubt is the expertise on our individual campuses, but whether they can be accessed and bundled in ways that our colleagues would feel it was valuable for them to share those resources is at a minimum challenging.
One of the things I think CAGS could actually step up to is to have a more clear definition of what expectations are realistic at these different levels.
That's, as you were speaking, that's exactly what I was thinking. Today, the session, there was a call for a taxonomy, so people actually could...
That came from the bar last night.
with more granularity, understand what we're talking about when we're talking a master's degree. Is it a master's degree that's a consolation prize, as some of our American colleagues refer to what happens from direct entry? Is it a professional master's? Is it a course-based master's? And so we need a more sophisticated taxonomy so that we understand if we're talking about the same thing or different things. And I think the other thing, back to your point, is the issue of defining very clearly what are the priorities, what are the imperatives in the degree requirements. And you pretty easily, in a given time frame, have to drop off what aren't your top two or three priorities. And short of some methodology that would allow you to develop some of those skills that fall farther down on your list through what you're doing to meet your two or three imperatives, then they're going to fall off. I think the challenge is, you know, what can we build? How can we build ways of thinking, ways of interacting in our programs that might give our students a little bit more of a vision about what it means, what those elements mean, and then we perhaps do if we're not willing to be critical in our thinking about how we deliver what we're delivering and also how we're delivering it at the graduate level.
I guess we'll sort of finish this up with Janice and I have a to-do list, apparently, to get CAGS to step forward on this. So stay tuned and we'll see what we come up to. Thank you very much, Janice.
Thanks, Carolyn.
That's it for this episode. If you'd like to get in touch with me about something you heard on this podcast or about an issue that you'd like to see covered, please email me at carolyn.waters@dal.ca. You can also leave a comment at the bottom of the page where this podcast is posted at universityaffairs.ca. Until next time, I'm Carolyn Waters, and thanks for listening.